Israel has triggered a wave of concern after announcing it will open the crucial Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, but only for Palestinians to exit the coastal strip. Gaza mediators, Egypt and Qatar, as well as six other Muslim-majority countries, have expressed their, quote, deep concern about the plan for a one-way exit for transfer of Gazan residents to Egypt. The statement was issued by Jordan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and the United Arab Emirates, along with the Gaza mediators. Israel's announcement envisions no return for Gaza residents to their homeland. That has raised fears of permanent displacement of Palestinians, a concept that the hardliner cabinet of the Israeli Premier Netanyahu has been promoting for months. The Hezbollah leader slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations, saying that the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and push to draw greater Israel. The remarks come after the UN Security Council delegation met with Lebanese officials to discuss ceasefire and Israeli aggressions, Mayim Saleh reports.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means.
One area where they might disagree is in terms of how far to go to eliminate Hezbollah. I think the Israelis would want to do that at all costs. I think for the Americans, at least for some people in the Trump administration, they realize that America has interests in Lebanon. By the way, they're building their biggest embassy in Lebanon. So would all-out chaos serve American interests in the end? If you want to have a big embassy, if you want to be influential in Lebanon, I think you need stability.
The speech coincided with a visit of a delegation of the UN Security Council members who met with Lebanese leaders and stressed the significance of the implementation of UN resolutions. During the meeting, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and withdraw from Lebanon. Experts believe UN resolutions are theoretically a framework for peace, while Israel has implemented none.
Basis for peace are these resolutions. They're supposed to be applied. For example, Resolution 242 calls for the withdrawal of the Israelis from the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and Jerusalem, whereas the Israelis are expanding their occupation in the Golan Heights. They are occupying parts of South Lebanon. They occupy Gaza. They are trying to also do an ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. They continue to kidnap a large number of Lebanese in violation of the ceasefire agreement, which is part of the Resolution 1701.
When asked about how the UN can enforce an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, the Russian ambassador to the UN says he hopes diplomatic efforts can bear fruit.
We can do whatever we can in the Council. But the Council doesn't have military means, of course.
During their meetings with Lebanese leaders, the UN delegation voiced support for stability in Lebanon. President Joseph Aoun stressed that Lebanon has always cooperated with the United Nations, but the main obstacle now, he said, was the Israeli occupation and aggression. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
In Yemen's southeast, tensions escalate as UAE-backed separatist forces tighten their grip on key provinces. They have seized strategic crossings and are moving towards vital energy regions. The rapid shifts in control have raised concerns of economic stability, regional security, and the future of any political de-escalation efforts. Abdul Latif Al-Bashali reports from Sana'a.
UAE-backed separatist forces from the Southern Transitional Council have dramatically expanded their influence in Yemen's southeast, securing full control of Hadramaut province. This advance comes despite a Saudi-mediated de-escalation agreement that has failed to halt combat operations. The separatists have moved eastward toward Mahra province on the Omani border, culminating in a full takeover.
The Southern Transitional Council is made up of several factions, including Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and unfortunately some thieves and mercenaries from the south, along with foreign elements. They have managed to seize those areas, and this is not merely a rotation of roles between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but an effort to plunder resources. Hadramaut holds oil and gold wealth, and we should not forget the increasing looting of antiquities in recent months.
Control of Mahra carries exceptional weight due to the inclusion of the Shahan land crossing. Shahan is Yemen's only gateway to Oman and a crucial artery for commercial imports such as electronics and vehicles. The crossing is viewed as the country's safest and most stable land route. Its seizure has sparked widespread regional concern given Mahra's strategic position and trade networks and its role in maintaining Yemen's fragile economic lifelines.
There is a project led by global arrogant powers, namely the United States and Britain. The project is implemented through their regional tools and aims to reshape Yemen's geography through these developments. We view this as an occupation reality and fully understand that what is happening today is not part of a Saudi-Emirati conflict, but rather a redistribution of zones of influence and control aligned with the Zionist project, especially in this highly sensitive time.
In a parallel escalation, separatist forces have begun extensive military movements toward Shabwa, a province rich in oil and gas fields. The push is seen as a direct attempt to widen control over Yemen's most economically significant areas. Heavy clashes have taken place, leaving large numbers of casualties and signaling a dangerous phase of renewed escalation that could further erode prospects for stability or political compromise.
From Hadramaut to Mahra and now toward Shabwa's energy fields, the accelerating advance of the separatist forces is reshaping Yemen's conflict map. The momentum on the ground signals a critical turning point that could redraw alliances and deepen regional repercussions. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dublin City Council has been condemned for postponing a decision to rename a public park that honors Israeli war criminals, the Herzog family. Pro-Palestinian activists argue the Herzog family name is incompatible with Ireland's stance on the genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes reports from Dublin.
Herzog Park on Orwell Road in Rathgar, Dublin, is named after former Israeli President Chaim Herzog, who was born in Belfast and raised in Dublin before emigrating to Israel. Local pro-Palestinian councillors argue that, given the genocide being carried out in Gaza by the Israeli regime, the park should no longer honour the Herzog family. The renaming effort has been temporarily stalled inside Dublin City Council due to a so-called legal technicality. Activists say that delay is unacceptable.
Isaac Herzog, who's the present president of Israel, he signed an artillery shell to go to Gaza. So this man is actually perpetuating and leading the genocide. And his father also led policies to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Dublin City Council is now facing national and international pressure to step back from the renaming proposal. Ireland's two governing party leaders have both spoken against altering the park's name. Campaigners say that stance is disgraceful and betrays Ireland's reputation for standing with oppressed people.
If you want to talk about the Herzog family and the person that was named for and talk about Judaism, that's one thing. But the Zionism for which it stands for right now should be renounced, and the renaming is essential.
Current Israeli President Isaac Herzog, son of Chaim Herzog, has condemned any renaming as, quote, shameful and disgraceful. Supporters of the name change counter that the facts are now undeniable.
We were just proud that he was, you know, became famous abroad, but we didn't realise his role in the genocide and in the depopulation of Gaza at that time. So I think there's a different set of facts and there's a different set of information now.
Although a decision to rename this park has been postponed for now, the issue is likely to come back onto the agenda in the future. Some of the new names already being proposed include Palestine Park or Gaza Park. Another suggestion has been to rename it Hind Rajab Park in honour of the Palestinian child brutally murdered by Israeli forces along with thousands of other children during the genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
Thousands of people have poured into the streets of various German cities to protest against conscription reforms, accusing the government of preparing for large-scale mobilization.
Yes, I am here today as a mother, and I am extremely worried about my two sons who will be affected by the new rules. And as a mother, I want to prevent that at all costs. I didn't raise my children to send them off to war afterwards.
Young people are on strike here today because they are not prepared to sacrifice 6 months of their lives to do military service. They say, we need a strong army again because we are threatened by Russia. This statement is not true.
It's a demonstration against conscription and compulsory military service. We don't want conscription. We don't want our sons to have to go to war.
Actually, this conscription must be seen in the context of the preparation for war. With the over 100 billion that have now been made available for this purpose, as a so-called special fund, I am firmly convinced that NATO is actively planning a war against Russia, and I am very afraid of that.
Protests were held in cities such as Berlin, Hamburg, and Munich, where demonstrators holding banners reading No to Compulsory Military Service. Some protesters called for investments in education and social welfare rather than military build-up. If the proposed law is approved, it would require all 18-year-old men to register for possible service with a lottery used if more soldiers are needed. Russia's war in Ukraine and rising defense commitments within NATO have renewed debate about reintroducing conscription in various forms. Pakistan and Afghanistan have once again exchanged deadly fire along their borders following the failed peace talks held earlier this week. Both sides are blaming each other for triggering the latest round of clashes in violation of a fragile ceasefire in place for the past 2 months. Afghan officials say at least 4 civilians were killed during the latest violence. A Taliban spokesman in Kabul claims Pakistani forces launched attacks in Spin Baldak district of Kandahar province. This is while Islamabad accuses Afghan troops of unprovoked firing near Chaman borders. Days earlier, the two countries held talks without any progress in Saudi Arabia. Despite the failure, both neighbors pledged to uphold the fragile ceasefire. The meeting was in the latest in a series of regional efforts to ease tensions following deadly border clashes in October. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has denounced the U.S. military threats against his country as acts of imperialist aggression in violation of international law.
This is nothing less than an illegal act of imperialist aggression, in direct violation of the UN Charter and international law. It is disproportionate, utterly excessive, extravagant, and unnecessary. Venezuela has never been, is not, and will never be a threat to the United States. On the contrary, Venezuela stands as a guarantee of security across the American continent. Venezuela is hope. Venezuela is the hope, the hope. It is hope.
Maduro made the remarks in the inauguration of the headquarters of the Bolivarian National Police Service Academy in Caracas. His remarks came as U.S. President Donald Trump received FIFA's inaugural Peace Prize during the World Cup draw ceremony at Washington's Kennedy Center. Meanwhile, the U.S. military announced it had killed 4 men in a strike on a vessel in international waters in the eastern Pacific on Thursday. Since September the 2nd, Washington has carried out around 21 such strikes on alleged drug shipments, leaving more than 84 people dead. The operations coincide with the Trump administration's intensified campaign against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You are listening to The Spring of Truth, and I'm Muhammad Liaquat Abbas, your host, and I'm going to present you a beautiful and a very powerful quote from Imam Khomeini. The Imam says, if this 100 million strong Arab population were to join forces, then even America wouldn't be able to stand in their way. A beautiful quote which has a lot of insights. Over here, we have a beautiful ayah from the Holy Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, and hold firmly to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala all together and do not become divided. Unfortunately, brothers and sisters, in today's world, this is what we see. Division, not unity. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, hold firmly to the rope of Allah, all together. And this is what we are not doing. The nations, the Muslim nations, are not acting upon this verse. They are creating disunity. They are not joining with one another. The rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala means the path of Islam, the beautiful path which binds us all together, which keeps us together, the religion of Islam. And in other narrations, we have the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. وَعْتَسِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ. So the Hablillah or the rope of Allah is none other but the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. If a person is upon the path of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and the path of Ahlul Bayt is no other different than the path of the Holy Quran. So the Ahlul Bayt, the Holy Quran, the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, everything is the same. And this very big path, the rope of Allah, teaches us to be together and not become divided. Over here, Imam Khomeini is saying, if this 100 million strong Arab population, what happened to the Arab population? Why aren't they following the religion of Islam? Why aren't they following the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? If they were, the population were to join the forces, then even America wouldn't be able to stand in their way. Even the strong forces, even the Western forces, those who claim themselves to be the superpowers won't be able to stand in front of the Muslim community, which is united like no other day. Over here, it is our responsibility to bring the sticks together. The collective strength of a united community can achieve what is impossible for the individuals.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Muhammadin.
If you see the religion of Islam, you have a lot of ahkam, you have a lot of Islamic laws when it comes to congregation. Example, pray your prayers, do your namaz, do your prayers in congregation with jama'at, right? You have salatul mayyit, which is mustahab if it is recited with jama'at, isn't it? You have everything together like hajj, it is a collective thing. It is a collective duty. Like basically, you have a lot of people beside you. It is very important. If you act all alone, then know that there are people and there are communities, there are animalistic featured human beings who want to pounce upon you and bring you down. But if you are acting as one nation, one Muslim nation, with all the millions and billions of people together, then know that no power. There's no power in this world, or no superpower in this world, who can stand up against you and who can bring you down.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Iran, a place whose story is far more complex than the headlines suggest. Over the past four decades, the country has quietly engineered one of the most dramatic transformations in public health anywhere in the world. In 1979, life expectancy in Iran was just 56 years. Today, it stands at 75, a 19-year leap. For comparison, during the same period, life expectancy in the United States rose only 3 years, and in France, 8. The numbers tell a story of rapid, determined progress, built on investment in healthcare, expanded insurance coverage, and a national push for better medical services. It's an undeniable sign of Iran's progress and capabilities in the medical field. One of the clearest indicators of a nation's health is maternal and infant mortality. Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, as access to clinics and trained medical staff increased, Iran saw maternal deaths fall to 20 per 100,000 live births. That's less than 1% of the global rate, which stands at roughly 200 per 100,000. Specialists in obstetrics and gynecology call it one of the country's quiet medical revolutions.
Still, some critics abroad often claim that Iran is a country that is defined only by its drones and missiles. But a deeper look inside the country's scientific institutions paints a very different picture.
Mr. Mohammad Reza Kompani, CEO of a high-tech medical equipment company, outlined how Iran's medical equipment sector has expanded since the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
The medical equipment of Iran has actually been started from the revolution, after the revolution. Before that, we had only the furniture and such things and autoclave for sterilization of the goods. But after that, about 10 years after the revolution, right after the ending the war, the medical equipment started the industry in Iran. And now, which I'm here, we have about 85% of the items are required to be used in the hospitals. I'm talking about the devices, because in medical equipment, we have two parts, the devices and the sundries and the disposables we used in the hospitals. So in the medical equipment, the devices, 85% of the hospitals are doing the equipping by the Ministry of Health are provided from the local manufacturers. It's the, as you see here, it's the operation room, the ICU, CCU, the dialysis section, the emergency, and the general hospital.
Iran's global ranking in science and research has climbed to 15th. 65 Iranian universities are now counted among the world's top institutions, 22 of them in medical sciences. Many cancers once considered fatal in Iran are now routinely treatable. 97% of the medicines Iranians use are produced inside the country. And through advanced transplants from cord blood to bone marrow, Iranian physicians now treat more than 70 diseases that once required travel abroad. In an interview with us, Iranian scientist Sepide Mirzayi Varzaghani, a Mustafa Prize laureate for scientists under 40 and a leading researcher in cancer drug resistance, highlighted Iran's giant leap in advanced therapeutic technologies, particularly in the field of gene therapy.
با دانشی که داریم و اینکه در حوزه زیست پزشکی ما امروز در دنیا حرف برای گفتن داریم و
With the expertise we have today, Iran has a real voice in the global biomedical arena. We've made significant progress in advanced therapeutic technologies, especially gene therapy. If there is sustained targeted investment, Iran can definitely become a regional hub for cancer research and cancer treatment.
4 decades ago, Iran ranked 39th in global scientific output. Today, it's 18th. In medical sciences alone, Iran has climbed from 38th to 10th worldwide. The country is among the 5 global leaders in advanced stem cell science, 2nd in the world in bone marrow transplantation, and among the top 10 nations in nanotechnology, biotechnology, and infertility treatment. In biotechnology, Iran is now one of only 3 nations producing a wide portfolio of high-tech biopharmaceuticals, including the hepatitis B vaccine, erythropoietin, multiple interferons, streptokinase, GCSF, and others. And for more than 20 years, Iran has practiced clinical cell therapy, an area where many countries remain stuck in the research stage. Stem cells are now used in corneal, cardiac, skin, and other transplants across Iranian hospitals. Ms. Mirzayi also explained how her research on drug resistance in cancer led to her receiving the Mustafa Prize. The Mustafa Prize, founded in 2012, is considered one of the most prestigious science and technology awards in the Islamic world.
Can you please tell us more about your research that resulted in you receiving the Young Scientist Mustafa Prize?
پژوهش‌هایی که من انجام دادم و در واقع منجر شد به دریافت این جایزه ارزشمند.
My research, which led to this valuable award, focuses on drug resistance in cancer. I study the role of intercellular signaling pathways that cause cancer cells to become resistant to chemotherapy. These molecular pathways inside the cell play a crucial role. After several treatment cycles, they can make the patient's body less responsive to anti-cancer drugs and reduce the sensitivity of cancer cells therapy. What we're trying to do is to identify and regulate these signaling pathways. Cancer cells can activate certain pathways that, in turn, lower their sensitivity to treatment. By mapping and modulating these pathways, we aim to reduce drug resistance and restore or even increase the responsiveness of cancer cells to anti-cancer drugs.
Education has played a major part in this transformation. Iran now has nearly 70 medical universities and faculties, staffed by 22,000 faculty members.
The country's medical system hosts about 270,000 domestic students and 7,000 international students. Researchers in these institutions have authored more than 60,000 conference papers, 81,000 journal articles, and over 258,000 papers published internationally. 25 Iranian medical universities have been included in the Leiden Ranking 2025, with Tehran, Shahid Beheshti, Tabriz, Shiraz, and Iran University of Medical Sciences ranking below 500 globally. Women's enrollment in universities has also increased, and women now make up 50% of students and faculty, an important accomplishment. Many of these graduates have achieved prominent national and international positions.
Iran's push for scientific independence shows up in its pharmaceutical sector as well. For instance, 99% of medications are produced domestically.
Iran also produces 40% of its medical equipment and requires no outside technical assistance for the development of pharmaceutical formulations. Something the country demonstrated during the Iran-Iraq War, the COVID-19 pandemic, and other crises. From 35 dependency-heavy drug companies in 1979, Iran has grown to more than 200 domestic pharmaceutical manufacturers today. Mr. Kompany also described how Iran weathered the COVID-19 pandemic using medical equipment supplied by domestic knowledge-based companies.
I'm telling you that for the rest of the products and the items which we have not produced yet, many, many science-based companies, which among of the 400 are working on them, and I will promise you in about 2 or 3 next year, we will have them as well. So there is no worry about the medical equipment, as we didn't have any problem during the corona. You see, in corona, we actually expend 6,000 ICU beds for the corona patients. So this means that we had the knowledge, we had the technology, we had the units, and all of them prevent us to choose the patients from the age and etc. to take it to the ICU. So every patient which needed to go to ICU, freely they could go. Then they hadn't had any problem. So corona was the one among the 10 to 15 countries in the world which has no problem. Iran was one of them.
Iran now ranks first in Asia in the production of recombinant medicines, drugs used to treat cancers, MS, hemophilia, and viral illnesses. Vaccination coverage for children under 5 has risen from 20% before 1979 to full nationwide coverage, even in remote villages. Iran has produced key pharmaceutical raw materials for treatments of pulmonary hypertension, coagulation disorders, and chemotherapy. It has introduced the first nanotechnology-based injectable anti-cancer drug, Sinadoxazom, among a long list of other high-tech drugs. Iran is now one of the world's top 3 producers of radiopharmaceuticals, about 70 varieties. These supply 230 treatment centers and 6,500 nuclear medicine units inside Iran and are exported to 15 countries, generating roughly $70 million annually. The only remaining imports are certain raw isotopes, mainly from Russia. Ms. Mirzayi also explained how combination therapies can ultimately help increase hope and survival prospects for cancer patients.
What are some of the practical and clinical applications of your research regarding the diagnosis or treatment of cancer in the near future?
اینها جزء درمان‌های در واقع درمان‌هایی که ترکیبی هستن و طراحی داروهایی که
These are part of what we call combination therapies and gene-based drug designs. Treatments that combine conventional anti-cancer drugs with genetic components. They can be highly effective in preventing and overcoming drug resistance, which is one of the biggest challenges in cancer treatment. We also focus on targeting personalized therapies so that one standard drug is not prescribed for all patients. Instead, treatment is tailored to each patient's genetic profile, because even 2 people with, for example, lung cancer can have very different patterns of drug resistance. Designing targeted drugs for each individual can significantly improve treatment outcomes, reduce overall costs, and most importantly, increase hope for patients living with cancer.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times. Over 1,140 Iranians among world's 1% most cited researchers. A total of 1,142 Iranian researchers have been recognized among the world's top 1% most cited researchers in 2025, compared to 1,056 identified researchers in 2024, according to the Islamic World Science Citation Institute. The Ministry of Health, Treatment and Medical Education accounts for 52.77%, and the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology, with 427 researchers, represents 37.43% of the most cited Iranian researchers, ISCIIR reported. Clinical medicine with 446 entries, engineering with 209 entries, pharmacology and toxicology with 163 entries, chemistry with 140 entries, neuroscience and behavior with 115 entries, agriculture sciences with 100 entries, and social sciences with 77 entries held the highest shares of the most cited researchers. Three Iranian researchers have been among the highly cited award recipients. IRNA. Iran among top 20 countries in medical science output, ISC. Iran ranks among the top 20 countries in terms of medical science publications indexed in the Scopus and Web of Science databases in 2023, according to figures from the Islamic World Science Citation Center. Given the importance of the health and medical fields and the advancements made by Iran in these areas, the ISC has prepared a report on the scientific and technological outputs in this sector, as well as on the most cited researchers and the global rankings of Iranian medical universities, ISC head Ahmad Fazlzadeh said on Saturday. Fazlzadeh pointed out that in comparison of different subject areas and the Web of Science databases, Iranian medical and health researchers have 158,678 documents in their names and the second highest scientific output from the country after engineering, technology, and natural sciences. ISNA. Iran among top three in radiopharmaceuticals expands nuclear scanners nationwide. Iran has established its position as one of the world's top three producers of radiopharmaceuticals, with statistics showing a nationwide increase in nuclear medicine imaging systems across all 31 provinces, according to reports. Radiopharmaceuticals technology, one of the major achievements of modern medicine, has driven significant advancements in diagnosing and treating complex diseases such as cancer over recent decades. Currently, Iran produces 70 types of radiopharmaceuticals, meeting the needs of more than 6,500 nuclear medicine centers nationwide. The country also exports these products to 15 countries, generating around $70 million in revenue in 2025. As part of efforts to achieve self-sufficiency, a cyclotron has been installed and commissioned at a hospital in Tehran to produce radioisotopes used in PET imaging. Mehr. Iran ranks 17th in world in science production, Minister. Iran's Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Hossein Simoisarov, says that Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of production of the scientific articles. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the cabinet session on November 12th, where he emphasized that the country is at the 17th rank in the world in the field of science production. The minister promised that his ministry would take effective steps to promote the level of science production on the regional and international stage. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
Medical tourism has become another thriving industry. In 2024, nearly a million patients from 160 countries traveled to Iran for treatments ranging from infertility and cosmetic surgery to cardiac care, ophthalmology, and organ transplantation. Diako Abbasi, Secretary of the Health Tourism Council, explained how Iran has become a destination for health tourism.
Over the past two decades, Iran has become one of the leading health tourism destinations in the region and even the world. This growth stems from our scientific and technological progress in medicine, the strong expertise of Iranian doctors in diverse specialities, Iran's strategic location near countries with serious healthcare challenges, and our shared cultural background and long medical tradition. All of this has helped make Iran a distinctive and attractive destination for health tourism.
The country also maintains one of the region's largest research networks, with 849 medical research centers. These laboratories fuel Iran's growing scientific partnerships abroad and boost its presence in global health diplomacy.
We currently have around 300 hospitals licensed to provide international health services, fully capable of admitting foreign patients at a professional level. Their staff receive cross-cultural training, and they have dedicated international patient departments that operate under official authorization. In addition, there are about 700 active health tourism offices and companies that handle medical visas as well as patients' accommodation, transfers, and specialized guidance during their stay.
In ophthalmology, Iranian hospitals offer services on par with the most advanced nations. The country no longer sends patients abroad for eye care. Instead, patients from neighboring countries come to Iran for surgery due to lower costs, modern equipment, and highly trained surgeons.
Last year, our medical centers admitted foreign patients from around 140 countries, which shows just how strong and promising Iran's health tourism market is. Most international patients come from cardiology and cardiovascular surgery, orthopedics, infertility treatment, transplants, ophthalmology, and ENT procedures such as cochlear implants, as well as cosmetic and general surgeries. They travel from countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, the Persian Gulf states, even Saudi Arabia, as well as European countries such as the UK and Germany. We've also received patients from countries like India and even from the United States and Australia. Our data clearly show that Iran is now treating patients from across the world.
Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 11,000 Iranians were sent abroad each year for medical care. Today, the flow has reversed. The country has performed over 50,000 kidney transplants, around 7,000 heart transplants, and 225 pediatric heart transplants. Every month, roughly 80 million medical services are delivered across the country. In recent years, Iran has also joined the list of medical equipment exporters. Officials announced at the Iran Health 2025 exhibition that Iranian-made medical technology is now shipped to more than 60 countries. More than 17,000 medical technologies have been registered inside Iran, and many are already on the global market. From vital sign monitors and defibrillators to dental and laboratory equipment, as well as precision surgical tools. Mr. Kompany also elaborated on the export of Iranian medical equipment products.
As we are meeting all the standards, international standards of the medical equipment for our product, as the MOH has based on that. So we now have a very good quality devices and also the disposables in the country. So we have no problem for that, and we are exporting about to 40 countries, and we are earning a lot of money among this exporting. And also, we have our own production line in different countries. And by doing the rebranding, by the cooperation of the local agents and our companies in Iran, we have about in countries like Indonesia, Turkey, Iraq, Sweden.
About 65% of Iran's medical device industry is powered by knowledge-based companies, many of which born in universities and science parks. This pipeline of engineers and researchers
has allowed Iran to develop high-tech devices such as AI-enhanced MRI machines, portable imaging units, and remote patient monitoring systems.
And there we have the Iranian ICU, which we have the ventilator, the special beds, the patient care monitoring system, and the gas supply. And as I told you, during the corona, all this set was equipped from the local manufacturer, so we didn't have problem. And the price was very attractive because at the corona, many countries has to pay 10 times, 8 times of the real price of the ventilator. But here, this unit was given to the MOH for 7,000 euro. But we had many offers from other companies like 50,000, 70,000, 40,000, different prices. But 6,000 of this unit was bought for only at the price of the 7,000 euro, which was very good. And now the real price in the world is about 10 to 12,000 euro.
Exports of medical equipment surpassed $500 million in 2024 and are projected to reach about $650 million by the end of 2025. West Asian and African countries are the largest buyers. The appeal: Iranian devices typically cost 30 to 40% less than their European counterparts, but offer comparable precision and reliability.
The quality is very good because they are meeting all these standards, international standards, and of course the price. Mm-hmm. For example, this operation room, the general operation room you see here, if you want to buy from a top brand company, European or American, you have to pay at least $200,000 to $300,000 US. But here you can get it for $70,000 US. So you see the different price.
And is it the same quality?
So it is.
You get the same quality, but for a lower price.
Of course. This is our advantage to entering to the market in international markets. So by having the people outside to cooperate with us, we will very soon will be anywhere in the world for the manufacturing of medical equipment and rebranding it.
Years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's healthcare system continues to grow. Through decades of expansion from hospitals and clinics in major cities to health centers in the most remote villages, the promise of equitable healthcare has been largely realized. And for millions of people across the country, that promise has become a lived reality. That's all for today. Until next time, take care.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. The U.S. dealt a heavy blow to the Iranian people. This is what happened on the 28th of Mordad. From that moment on, the Iranian nation came to know the U.S. It knew what a dangerous entity the U.S. was for the country. So we have known the U.S. since the 28th of Mordad. It wasn't something new to us. What I want to say is that after the coup took place, they brought the fugitive Mohammad Reza back to the country, and for 25 years, that hard-hearted, tough, oppressive dictator ruled the people. During all of that time, the United States stood by Mohammad Reza and supported him. The U.S. was a source of assurance for him. Now, this true enemy of the Iranian nation has an embassy here. This true enemy of the Iranian nation. When the revolution took place, the Americans were the first to oppose it. The U.S. Senate passed a resolution against the Iranian nation and against the revolution. Soon afterward, they allowed Mohammad Reza entry into the United States. They housed him in a hospital under the pretext of medical treatment, but their political and security agencies maintained contact with them. The Iranian nation realized this, and the people were furious. Demonstrations against the U.S. erupted in the streets. Why? Because the people sensed that the events that had taken place on the 28th of Mordad were about to be repeated, and that taking Mohammad Reza to the U.S. was a prelude to bringing him back to Iran using the various methods the Americans have. The people became furious. They took to the streets and staged demonstrations. A part of these demonstrations was the movement of the university students who entered the embassy and seized it. However, they didn't intend to stay in the embassy. It's important for everyone to understand this. The students weren't planning on staying inside the embassy. They only wanted the world to see the Iranian nation's fury over the U.S. granting entry to the Shah. That was all. Their intention was to go, stay for 2 or 3 days, and then come out. This was the students' intention. But after they went inside the embassy, they discovered documents there showing that the matter was much graver than they had initially thought. This wasn't just about a resolution passed by the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Embassy was a center for conspiracy, plotting, and strategizing to sabotage the revolution.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. From Tehran, a warm greetings to each and every one of you, dear listeners. Welcome to Iran Radio, your daily source of inspiration and reflection. Broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Together, we'll explore moments of faith, seek knowledge, and share stories that bridge hearts across the distances. So whenever you are at home, on the road, or taking a quiet moment, stay with us. A rich tapestry of voices, insights, and culture awaits you. First up, we have today's special. This daily program is a vibrant fusion of faith and culture, exploring various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Get ready for a rich tapestry of Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, inspiring nasheeds, insightful reports, and so much more. Then get ready to listen to the hadith of the day. Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish shares a profound hadith from the Holy Prophet and his revered family, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. You'll get a brief explanation and commentary, often trying into significant dates on your lunar or solar calendars. It's a moment of reflection you'll carry with you throughout the day. Next, tune in for another captivating segment from our very own Iran Radio's productions. Following that, it's time for Let's Recite the Quran. This program draws you closer to the Holy Book, guiding you through eloquent recitation at level 2. We'll explore tajweed points through a compare and match method, applying them to the beautiful